everyone. Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Geoffrey Wonsall, and I'm here on my own today because Molly's, as ever, rushed off her feet one way and another. But we'll be back together very shortly. But I thought it's very important to keep up the podcast rhythm. We will have a break at Christmas, but otherwise we're still going to keep on keeping on till then. Thank you so much for listening. It really does make a huge difference to me. I mean, I sit here and talk to myself about terrible things, and it's wonderful to know that you're out there. I know I can't see you all, but I can imagine you all, and it's very exciting, especially when, well, one really is dealing with quite a lot of horribleness, and it's nice to know that there are people out there who are actually interested. And I'm very grateful, very. And then I know Molly is as well. And I've just been sent a new list of suggestions, and one of which I was absolutely certain I'd done, a suggestion for a case. And I thought, I know I've done that case. And I looked at all through our list of podcasts, and I hadn't. I must have done it for something else, another, you know, television documentary or something. Anyway, it was suggested by a very nice lady called Becky Porter, who has actually suggested two really good ideas. This one is a man called Anthony Hardy. But Becky's also suggested a very interesting case called a man called Alan Kite, K-Y-T-E. Thank you to Becky, and indeed to all the people who've taken the trouble to suggest. We will get to them all gradually, slowly, but it's so good that there is such enthusiasm out there for thinking up cases that we might do. It's very exciting, in a way, because it means I don't feel alone, and I think there is a sense in which, if you do what I do, you spend an awful lot of time on your own, quite often in the company of pretty nasty people, and it makes such a difference when you realise there are other people out there who are interested. So thank you always. So this is the case of a man called Anthony John Hardy, who is known as the Camden Ripper. Anthony Hardy was born on the 31st of May 1951 in Burton-on-Trent in Staffordshire. He was a very intelligent child. There were none of the classic symptoms of serial killers. There's no arson, no bedwetting, no harming small animals. As far as we know, he had a pretty happy childhood. He certainly was a clever. He excelled at school. He was in every way unremarkable. Perhaps one thing that set him apart is he was rather a sort of lumpy boy. There was nothing smooth or handsome about him. He was just really rather blunt-faced. But nevertheless, he went to university, went to Imperial College in London, got an engineering degree, and indeed was to meet his wife at Imperial, and then went on to be a manager for an engineering company. I mean, so far, so incredibly ordinary. Indeed, they married and they had three sons and a daughter. So far, so extremely normal. Anyway, in pursuit of a better life, the family departed for Australia. And indeed, they went to live in Tasmania, which is a beautiful part of the world. And somewhere to be treasured, really. But there was clearly something unhappy about Anthony Hardy. Perhaps it was to do with his own character. What is not really ever properly explained about Hardy is that he had what effectively was a psychotic break. Despite having four children, he became very angry with his wife. And in 1982, and this was perhaps the harbinger of what was to come in Hardy's life, he went to elaborate lengths to try and kill her. He put a bottle of water in the fridge, in the freezer, and froze it so that it became a sort of weapon. And while she was asleep, he hit her over the head with it, rendering her, not surprisingly, unconscious. He then picked her up and attempted to drown her in the bath. I know, utterly unexpected. Clearly the marriage was in difficulties. I don't think you would, if it wasn't, anybody would expect this to happen. But goodness me, to hit her over the head and then try and drown her. Well, he was arrested, not surprisingly. She, thank goodness, survived. But I think she declined to press charges against him. And in fact, in 1986, she divorced him. Well, I suppose the collapse of his marriage and his separation from his children had a big impact on his life. Hardy went into a tailspin. He spent some time in mental hospitals, where he was diagnosed as being bipolar. A dramatic change, you'd have thought, wouldn't you, from a perfectly ordinary life before. He comes back to London. And in fact, I mean, the spiral just gets worse and worse. He descends into drug abuse, alcoholism, and he's diagnosed with diabetes. He moves from homeless hostel to homeless hostel. He's convicted of thefts, small thefts, and of being drunk and disorderly. He clearly has a mental problem. Now, this is not to excuse, not for one moment to excuse his actions, but he clearly had gone over the edge. Now, was it to do with his wife? Was it to do with his sex life? It's a very shadowy picture, this. I don't quite know what was going on, but he clearly had a thing about prostitutes. Because in 1998, he was arrested when a prostitute, a sex worker, claimed he'd raped her. It's possible. There's no doubt he had the capacity for violence, as the episode in Tasmania shows. But the charges were dropped in the end, as they so often are in these kind of cases, when it was he said, she said. And let's not beat about the bush, I don't think many in law enforcement are all that sympathetic to the plight of sex workers. Whatever happened, he went back to the cycle of despair, the spiral of downward descent into hell, really. He was living in a flat in Camden in North London. Actually, not very far from where I live. I too live in the borough of Camden, although not in the bit that Anthony Hardy lived in. He was obviously very difficult, potentially violent, supported by benefits. He didn't really manage to hold down a job, which is a tragedy for a man who was obviously clever and had a wonderful education. But in January 2002, the police were called to the block in which Anthony Hardy lived because a next-door neighbour claimed that he had vandalised her front door. There'd obviously been a confrontation of one kind or another, and he'd lost his temper and he'd written graffiti on her front door. She was, not surprisingly, incensed and duly called the police. The police arrive and they knock on Hardy's door. Hardy is presumably the worse for wear and opens the door to the police, who ask to come in. He invites them in. And they explain, and he says, doesn't really make any comment particularly. And they said, would you mind if we had a look round, Mr. Hardy? And Hardy says, no, of course not. So they look round, it's only not a big flat. And they find one room where the door's locked. Could we see inside this room, Mr. Hardy? Oh, no, I don't think I've got a key. Really? You're living in a flat with one locked door and you haven't got a key to it? Well, Hardy flaps. Eventually, a key is produced and the police open it, the door, to find the naked dead body of a young woman lying on the bed. She has cuts and bruises to her head. There is a bucket of warm water beside her, and there are quite a lot of blood. The police, not surprisingly, take a very dim view of this and arrest him. Hardy offers almost no explanation. Eventually, the lady, the naked dead body, is identified as a girl called Sally White, who's 38, and a sex worker. Well, it certainly looks on the surface as though Hardy may have killed her. And now enters another character in this extraordinary story. A pathologist, a forensic pathologist called Dr. Freddie Patel, examines the body of Sally White and comes to the conclusion, in spite of the cuts and bruises, that she suffered a heart attack. Hardy insists that because he was drunk almost all the time, he had no idea how she got in there, no idea where she came from. He'd never met her in his life before, and as far as he was concerned, it was completely coincidence. He failed to explain how it was that the door was locked. But, well, I suppose the police thought at that point, well, he's a poor soul, and, well, we don't think we'll worry too much about this. And in fact, the case against Hardy was dropped. Well, it's also fair to say that while he's in custody, Hardy has been transferred to a psychiatric hospital under the Mental Health Act of 1983. No further action at that point is taken. Hardy is being looked after, really, in a psychiatric hospital. Throughout the year 2000, I mean, Sally's body is found in January 2002, and White spends almost all the rest of the year in a mental hospital. But he's released in November 2002. Presumably because they believed, the authorities in the mental hospital believed, that he was safe. That he, you know, he was no longer a danger to anybody. It's so difficult. I'm not attributing any blame to anyone, but it just is so difficult to know when a man has regained sanity. You could argue, and in fact, as we'll see, perhaps it should have been argued, that Hardy was a danger to society. But no, in fact, he's released back to the flat in Camden. Just a matter of weeks later, over Christmas in 2002, Anthony Hardy clearly kills again. In fact, he's now taken to dismembering his victims. Hence the name, the Camden Ripper. And on the 30th of December 2002, a homeless man scavenging for food is going through the bins outside the block of flats when he finds a female leg and then another female leg in the black plastic bin bag. Gradually, other bits of limbs emerge. An arm, another arm. The head of the victim is never found. In fact, there's more than one victim. There are two victims. And they are eventually identified as both sex workers, as a girl called Bridget McLennan, who's 34, and Elizabeth Vallad, who's 29. Well, given the history, there's no question whom the prime suspect in these killings must be. It's, of course, Anthony John Hardy. But Hardy has disappeared before the homeless man starts searching the bins. I mean, Hardy didn't go to any elaborate lengths to hide the bodies of these two poor victims. He made no attempt whatever. He disappeared. And he disappeared for almost a week. The police eventually find Hardy by the very good piece of police work. They knew he needed an insulin prescription. So they went to search for where he normally got his insulin from. And, believe it or not, did the old-fashioned thing of waiting for Hardy to show up. It was, again, a hospital in Camden. There weren't that many. And Hardy shows up. A police constable recognises him. He's got quite a remarkable face. It is, as I said at the beginning, it's rather sort of square. And it's not at all handsome. If you look at the pictures, if you look him up, you'll see what I mean. He's a big, bulky man with a stubble and strange eyes. I mean, I'm not trying to demonise him, but he doesn't look like... He looks like a man you wouldn't want to quarrel with. Anyway, a fight ensues. The police constable goes up. Hardy fights him. One officer is knocked unconscious. Another officer is stabbed in the hand and has his, believe it or not, he's hit so hard by Hardy, who's such, as I say, a big man, his eye is dislocated. But eventually, Hardy is subdued and taken into custody. A search of his flat by the police finds conclusive evidence of the dismemberment of these two poor ladies during the Christmas holidays. It's now abundantly clear, or must be, to the police, that Sally White, the first victim, described by the pathologist as having died of a heart attack, was almost certainly killed, and the police intervened before Hardy had had an opportunity to dismember them. The pathologist who called her described her as dying from a heart condition, was later struck off by the General Medical Council over another very poorly conducted pathologist examination of a newspaper seller called Ian Tomlinson, who died during a riot in the City of London in 2009. Hardy goes completely no comment. The officers put the evidence that they have to him, and he says nothing at all in response. He simply goes no comment to every suggestion they make to him. Well, the Crown Prosecution Service are quite clearly convinced that Hardy is guilty and should be brought to trial. Well, a year passes, almost, and he's about to be brought to trial, and the evidence is procured, and the witnesses are ready, and the pathologist reports are there. Still parts of the victims are missing. Where those went, it still remains a mystery. But on the very day of the trial, and I suspect on the advice of his barristers, Hardy changes his plea. He admits not only the murder and dismemberment of the two victims in the bins outside his flat, but also to the murder of Sally White, whom he clearly intended to dismember. Now, perhaps we should give you a little bit more background. Hardy has surrounded himself with satanic images, the devil. He's graffitied the walls of the flat. He's clearly hugely disturbed, and that's not an excuse. I'm simply saying that this was the scene in his flat in Camden. And the only way you can say is he's deranged in some way or another. And because of those psychiatric problems, and now his plea of guilty to three murders, which of course under our system makes him a serial killer, they have an intense independent investigation into his care. He's diagnosed with personality disorder and sent to a psychiatric hospital. Hardy is collaborative, but still deeply, deeply strange. Clearly, the authorities believe that he represents a danger to the population. But I think they're also convinced that he isn't necessarily in need of persistent psychiatric care. And in fact, he's returned to the prison system. In 2010, the High Court, in the shape of Mr. Justice Keith, orders that Hardy should never be released. And this is in May 2010, because of what he's done. And Keith says in his judgment, "This is one of those exceptionally rare cases in which life should mean life." Hardy is returned to HMP Frankland in Durham, where he remains disturbed, dangerous, and difficult until on the 26th of November 2020 he dies after contracting sepsis at the age of 69. The police are convinced that Hardy was responsible for a number of other killings in which involved sex workers and dismemberment. In particular, they're interested in two murders in Nottinghamshire and one in Fulham in 1991, and another one in Walthamstow in 1995. But there is insufficient evidence to proceed against Hardy for those killings. At one point, the detectives were convinced that Hardy had killed at least a further five people. But of course, we shall never know for sure. He represents one of the most dangerous of all killers, targeting people who won't be missed, who don't have families who worry about them, who are itinerant, and who live on the fringes of society. It's many ways a tragedy. No, Anthony Hardy isn't a tragedy, but what happened to those young women was. Hardy deserves no sympathy. But the question, the fascinating question remains, what on earth set him off? What was it that turned him from a successful engineer with a wife and family of four into a man who descended into a sort of alcoholic, drug-fueled, bipolar hell of his own making, in which he's fascinated by the devil? And how did that happen? Unfortunately, we've never had a case study of Hardy. He would have been a very interesting case to study. Where did those triggers, where did it happen? He died, as I say, in November 2020, during the COVID epidemic, but it wasn't COVID, it was sepsis. I do not shed a tear for Anthony John Hardy. It would be impossible to do so. He was a deeply dangerous man. But my goodness, what a fascinating case. So that is the story of the Camden Ripper, Anthony John Hardy. It's one I thought I'd done for this series, for this podcast, but I hadn't, and it's very interesting, because I can remember the discovery of the bodies, or the bits of the bodies, by that homeless man vividly. I mean, it was big news over Christmas 2002. Amazing. Anyway, thank you. I hope you've enjoyed it. I've got to thank all the people who help us, of course. And most of all, I sort of miss Molly. It's very nice to have someone to talk to, as well as just talking to yourself for half an hour. But I miss Molly. But thank you to Sam Brain, our wonderful producer, to my son Dan, who composed the music, to George, who drew the caricatures, to Audio Boom for hosting us. But most of all, I'd like to thank you, the listeners, the people who have stayed with us over these last 5 years, and to whom we're abundantly grateful. I mean, I can't tell you. It's just so charming and so wonderful. Thank you so much. And as I often say, do be careful out there.